Maybe we could just jump right into it. Could you walk me through the sequence of events here? How did this happen?
Well, it was the first part of the game, I believe. And always extra special when I get to play in Seattle in front of my family, get a little hyped up.
Johnny Hecker grew up in Bothell, but when he took the field in Seattle in 2015, it was against the Seahawks. At the time, he was a St. Louis Ram, L.A. Ram now. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This is Sound Effect. And what Hecker did next made him infamous here in the Northwest.
It was just running down after I punted the ball, saw a body there, and decided to give him a little nudge. And, man, did not anticipate him going to the ground like that. Just caught him right at the right moment. You know, he's a big guy.
Personal foul. Unnecessary roughness, number six.
And then as soon as he hit the ground, I thought, man, oh, no.
When did it dawn on you who you had just given a shove to?
Right after he got back up, yeah, I saw it was Cliff Averill.
You see him take a shot here, Cliff Averill. I don't know if you want to go around doing that to that guy.
I wasn't trying to be tough or anything. I was just, you know, giving a guy a nudge, like a little running down the field. And
let's unpack the dynamic a little bit for people who might be like a Fairweather fan.
Okay.
So you are a big guy, but punters are not sort of stereotypically giants.
Right.
But Cliff Averill is.
Right. Big man. So we're actually not too far off sideline. Might be a little bit taller, but he's definitely got me in some muscle poundage.
But he's also kind of a trained killer, right?
Yes, yeah.
He's a pass rusher. He is. Right. He's out there to level people.
Yes.
And you're typically not having a lot of contact.
More of a finesse player, yeah. You know, it was a dumb play. And, of course, now I got four of the biggest guys on their team all mad at me trying to rip my head off. So I knew it was kind of going like self-preservation mode. It wasn't the most bright idea I've ever had in my life, I'll tell you that.
And how did the self-preservation mode play out?
Michael Bennett is a charging bull, and I am a matador, in a sense. Just trying to not, you know, get gored out there in front of thousands. And,
so he takes a run at you on your next punt.
Yeah, he did. And I wasn't really having that. I punted the ball and shied away from contact, some would say.
He's going to avoid any kind of penalty. They saw what he did last time. Look, they want revenge.
I hate to needle you on it, but I describe physically how you evaded that maneuver. Like, what was your evasive maneuver?
There was a bit of going to the ground,
and
using
maybe
the hands and shoulder,
protecting your vital organs.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I already have a helmet protecting my head, so just curling up, kind of protecting the rest of the body and not leaving myself open to attack. Yeah.
And how did Averill and some of his teammates react? And did that change like in the heat of the moment versus a little later?
Of course, the heat of the moment, they were all very, very upset. But, you know, as time went on, they realized, you know, it's part of the game. We'll just let him live. You know, I got a lot of flack on the internet and all over. So it was the kind of thing where I think they realized that I had done more damage to myself than they could probably do. So it's just crazy because that kind of stuff happens. Then you have little third graders calling you all sorts of cuss words on the internet and saying you're a wuss. And you're like, wow.
So when all said and done, do you regret doing it?
Do I regret doing it? That's a difficult question. There's yes and no. You know, that's how I play. I'm shouldn't really apologize for being an aggressive player and just building an identity of being a tough guy, I guess.
Well, you're also a really good sport to come in and talk to
course.
Us about it.
Thank of course,
you so
man.
Much.
Yeah. No hiding here. I'm excited. I'm in the area, so just to get to kind of clear my name a little bit. City of Seattle, please, you can love me now. Please.
Bothell native Johnny Hecker and punter for the LA Rams. Johnny was one of hundreds of people over the years that I had the delight to talk to on Sound Effect. And forgive me if I'm a little reflective today, but this is my last episode hosting Sound Effect. I'm going to be transitioning to a new role outside of KNKX, working in public health. But you know, I wouldn't be able to walk away without a look back at a few of my favorite stories. And up next is some of the most fun I've ever had making radio. It's a little spin through history in the early days of Seattle's Woodland Park Zoo. Back then, all the monkeys were kept in cages until in 1940 they were relocated to a little human-made island surrounded by a shallow moat. The result was war, an all-out battle for dominance on Monkey Island that captured the city's attention that summer. Of course, a real war was brewing at that time, and perhaps as a little comic relief from the grim news out of Europe and Asia, the daily papers in Seattle breathlessly covered the Monkey War, tongues firmly in cheek. We present to you now a selection of excerpts, word for word, from the Seattle Times and PI's coverage of the war on Monkey Island.
Dictator commands fighting zoo monkeys, and all's well. Woodland Park monkeys that were moved from their cages Tuesday to their new Monkey Island have had a civil war and set up a government headed by a Chinese monkey named Sing. The monkeys that had been living in separate cages for years at the zoo huddled together in their original cage groups when they were first put on the Monkey Island. Then they started fighting. If a monkey got licked badly, the other monkeys threw him in the moat. We had to put the down and outers in cages again.
Monkey apes dictators, or is it vice versa? Rebellion looms. Ruled by a stir-crazy Chinese monkey named Sing, the 16 inhabitants of Woodland Park Zoological Gardens' new Monkey Island were plotting revolution yesterday, much to the amusement of spectators, but to the great concern of the zoo superintendent, solemn Dr. Gus Knutson. Sing, assigned to command of the island kingdom after two other simian dictators had failed dismally to unite warring factions, turned in a good first-day performance, knocked half a dozen malcontents into the moat, and cowed the others into reasonable submission. Is the boss crazy? He undid it all yesterday, however, by continually biting his own tail and then screaming with pain, an act which cast grave doubts upon his sanity.
Sing Dynasty on Monkey Island ends. Dictator gets dunking. The high-branded and tyrannical rule of Sing, the Chinese dictator who governed with absolute power on the Woodland Park Monkey Island for the past 2 days, came to an abrupt and ignominious end in the presence of hundreds of excited spectators. 17 Filipino monkeys who had been Sing's abject subjects since Friday rose in rebellion, dethroned him without ceremony, and drove Sing into the moat.
Zoo monkeys deposed flea-bitten dictator. The greatest sea battle of the War of Monkey Island was fought at sunset today, with the result that the mad monk of China, Tingling Sing, was badly defeated and exiled to that dismal St. Helena of Woodland Park, the Monkey House.
Truce declared in Monkey War. Outwardly, all was quiet on the Monkey Island battlefront here today, except for occasional fisticuffs between the monkey factions. But dissension was glaringly apparent as the different rivals for leadership in the simian community made faces at each other and held councils of war from time to time.
Queen is planning to make monkeys out of dictators. The slap-happy inhabitants of Woodland Park's new Monkey Island were pretty cocky today after having performed to a Sabbath crowd that Zoo Director Gus Knutson estimates at 25,000 persons. But they'd better not get too chesty in their newfound notoriety, for a female is plotting against them. She's no ordinary Monkeyland Machiavelli, though. She's none other than Cheetah, the African Queen.
Monkey Isle under suspicion. There is so much revolution and strife on Woodland Park's Monkey Island that Dr. Gus Knutson, the zoo director, says he may have to appeal the United States Immigration and Naturalization Service to investigate the monkeys and weed out the undesirable aliens. I don't know how most of these monkeys got into the country, said Dr. Knutson. They may have come in illegally. All I know is that people bring them here and say, "How about taking this monkey?" And so I take the monkey and ask no questions. Adam, the stool pigeon, fell under Dr. Knudsen's suspicion as a fifth columnist. Adam is a small monkey who spends all his time shadowing other monkeys, gossiping about politics and generally stirring up trouble.
In Zoo Hospital, Sing reposed today in the quiet of the zoo hospital, where he's nursing quite a few cuts and scratches received in the big naval battle when he was almost drowned. Never again will Sing be placed on the island, according to Knudsen. Knutson believes a permanent ruler will emerge on the island within a few days. Meanwhile, none of the monks seem to trust each other, and Knutson is keeping a watchful eye on the proceedings to be sure there are no casualties.
This is Sound Effect from KNKX. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and I'm celebrating some of my favorite stories on today's show. So do me a favor, picture Sasquatch. For me, it's a very specific image. It's a big, hairy humanoid, mid-stride, arms swinging, head turned to glance back over its right shoulder. It's an iconic picture. And the thing that Bigfoot was turning back to look at was Bob Gimlin. Gimlin, along with Roger Patterson, gathered their famous film footage in Northern California in 1967. 50 years later, people still pore over it, debating its authenticity and speculating on how it might have been faked. Well, that film, which launched 1,000 Bigfoot hunters, also ruined Bob's life. Bob Gimlin lives in Yakima. He's a man of many interests. It's just that most of them have to do with horses.
This is the old stud horse. He's an old-timer. Step on the outside. Step out.
We are at a friend's farm in Yakima, where Bob keeps most of his horses. He's spent decades making his living around animals.
This old sleigh here, I'd hook Kilargo, that stallion, when he was young, to this sleigh and give the kids rides in here.
Bob is a real-deal cowboy. He used to break horses. He rode in an honest-to-God sheriff's posse. And, of course, he rode in rodeos. When he was young, at least. He's 86 now.
I quit rodeoing altogether in 1958 and enjoyed rodeo, and that's where I met Roger Patterson at the rodeos.
Bob and Roger hit it off. But then, after Bob quit the circuit, they didn't see each other for a few years, until one day in 1961.
I stopped at my uncle's service station down in Union Gap, and the guy walked out, and it was Roger.
As they caught up, Roger told Bob he wanted to show him something. He came back with a large plaster cast of a footprint, a big footprint. Well, Bob wasn't sure what to make of that, but he was open-minded enough that one day later, when Roger came knocking, he was willing to listen.
So he come running into my place, and he said, "Bob, can you take me to Northern California?" And I said, "Well, can't do it now." He said, Labor Day weekend, they found all these tracks down there after they come back to work.
Bob agreed to load up 3 horses in his trailer and head down to the area around Willow Creek in Northern California. The 2 men mounted up and headed deep into the woods on old logging roads.
The leaves were all changing, reds and yellows, and it was pretty rugged, you know, it was hills like that. We were just riding up there, and Roger was taking pictures of me on the horse and leading the pack horse. That's when Roger's horse started just the jumping and the lunging. And I could see that there was something going on there. I look over there, and there's a Bigfoot standing just on the other side of the creek from us. But he just immediately turned, started walking away. Well, Roger, by then, had got his camera out of the saddlebag on his horse. And he was up running across the creek there. He hit the other side of the bank and stumbled and kind of fell down on his elbows. And that's when it made that famous head turn. It's when I stepped down off the horse. My mind thought, well, yeah, these things really do exist. After all this I heard about them and stuff, and I've been wanting to see a track, here's one walking right away from me, right in front of me here.
There was no doubt in Bob's mind. This was no hoax. This was Bigfoot. Once they'd calmed their horses down, they tried to follow her. She appeared to be a rather heavy-bosomed female, but to no avail.
And then we talked about the smell and different things and musky, skunky smell. And Roger said, "Oh, it smelled like an old dog that rolled in cow." And I said, "Well, yeah, maybe that."
Once the shaky footage was developed, Roger was giddy. He was sure he had a gold mine on his hands. But Bob was not so impressed.
When I first saw the film, I thought, "Oh, that ain't nothing." I said, "I saw a lot more than that." So I was kind of the bad guy.
So that was the first crack in their friendship. They hit the road with the film, trying to interest investors and maybe sell the story to Hollywood. But Bob says his heart wasn't in it. He had horses to take care of.
You know, there was a lot of disagreement right from the get-go. I said, "I got to go back to work and make a living."
Still, Roger and his associates continued the roadshow with one major difference.
They hired some guy that said he was me.
So touring the country, making money with a Bob Gimlin impersonator.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that was it for Bob and Roger. Bob says the two never spoke again. That is until Roger was on his deathbed.
His brothers called me and said, Bob, he's asked to see you. So I went to see a little old write-up guy there in a bed, and he rallied up a little bit and said, Bob, oh, man, it's so good to see you. And I said, yeah, Rog. Bobby said, I apologize. And I said, well, why did you hire a guy and he saves me? Well, he said, we had to do something to get people to come in. And I said, well, dadgummit, Roger. He said, Bob, he said, I've got the money and the means and stuff now and the equipment. He said, as quick as I get well, you and I are going to go back down there to California and capture Bigfoot. Well, that was in the afternoon, and he was dead the next morning.
Bob says he forgave Roger at that point. But still, he seethed that this had turned into a payday for others, but not for him.
My wife said, let's just get away from it, Bob. You went through so much over that, and it's bothered you a lot and made a different person out of you.
What did she mean by that, that it's made a different person out of you?
Well, I was a person that never held grudges against anybody. Now, once you're thinking about hurting somebody.
And Bob chafed at the mockery, the constant mockery that seemed to follow him wherever he went. When the ridicule reached his wife at her bank job, that was the breaking point.
They razzed her about it in where she was working, and she'd come home bawling and saying, oh, God, Bob, I wish you'd have never went down there with Roger. And I said, I do, too.
So Bob disowned Bigfoot. He stopped doing interviews and answering mail about it.
I used to get really upset, but kept saying, I keep my temper, trying to just stay away from it for that 35 years until Dimitri said, I'm coming to the United States to have some time with you. Dmitry Baranov, a Russian scientist, one of the top Russian scientists, he said, well, if Bob can't make it to Russia, I'll come to the United States to have some time with him.
Baranov has written about Sasquatch, as well as its counterpart, what they call the Russian snowman. He came to the U.S. to attend a conference in California, and he convinced Bob Gimlin to go along with him. Reluctantly, Bob agreed to give a talk.
And that's about all I can tell you about that short-term footage.
He didn't know what to expect. For decades, his story had gotten nothing but ridicule.
It's still in my mind real clear, but when I see it, I'm probably going to be a different story.
It was like lifting a weight off my shoulders. Here's all these people just anxious to hear what went on and believed in me. And when I walked in the room, standing ovation. And I thought, now, wait a minute. How did this turn around in a few days?
Not only was he accepted by this group of believers, he was revered. He was a rock star. He started going to Bigfoot conferences again, giving interviews again, signing autographs. But not everyone in Bob's life was on board, which partially explains why he and I are talking inside of a Jeep parked at his friend's farm and not at his place.
My wife allows it, but she will not go to any of them with me because of the bad days that she had. She just says, I won't allow anybody that has anything to do with it to come to my place and do any filming or any interviews. You do what you want to, but I'm not going to go do any of it.
And that's sort of the agreement that Bob made with the world, too. He knows what he saw, and if you don't believe him, fine. You're the sucker.
I strongly believe if a real one walked in the house and sat down at a table, or the best it could, and they'd say, no, it's a fake, somebody in a suit. That's how naive they are. So that's just the way I'd tell them till the day they spank me in the face with dirt, you know.
Start at the Hebulb Cultural Center near Marysville.
Yashta is my Indian name. Lois Landgreeb is my English name.
Lois is a Tulalip tribal member who, for 23 years, has taught a language called Lushootseed.
One of my favorite is the word for frog, and that is wuk, wuk. The word for bird is k-h-a-cub. And another one is eagle. It sounds like wings on air. Yahwala.
Lushootseed is endangered. Lois says maybe 55 people speak her dialect fluently. And as you can probably guess, it's not an easy language to just pick up, especially when, like Lois, you were 25 years old and starting from scratch. That's because Lois did not start out on a path toward becoming a tribal culture bearer. Instead, her life has taken a series of unexpected turns, starting with when she was just minutes old.
I was relinquished at birth. My birth mother held me for 5 minutes, and she gave me up. I was in foster care for almost a year, and I was adopted by a white family, and they adopted both me and my brother. So we're not blood siblings, but we look at each other as we're practically like blood. My adopted mother, she had had miscarriages and stillborn, so that's why they adopted. She had a miracle baby, and it was my sister. So just before she was born, the neighborhood kids informed us that they're going to give us back, that they're going to give us up because they now have their own child. And we didn't know that we were adopted. We did not figure anything out any differently. It's really funny because my dad and mom would get pink and sunburned in the summer. And my brother and I would get dark brown. It never occurred to us. We just figured that's the way it was. So,
how old were you when those neighborhood kids were telling you that you were going to be given back?
6 years old. 6 and 7. So my brother and I decided we're going to be the best children ever. They can't give us back. So we devised a plan to just behave ourselves. And we messed up like children do. And we broke down and started crying. We sobbed uncontrollably for like 5 minutes. Don't give us away. We want to stay. They really had to sit with us and explain that, yes, we're sorry you found out this way, and that we went out and seeked you out. We picked, you know, we could have picked any children, any babies, any, but we saw you two, and that's who we wanted, and we're not giving you back.
So you learned at that time, though, that you were Native. You didn't know any more than that. What was your relationship like to your nativeness?
There was basically just the romance stereotype attachment. Basically, I loved getting my hair braided. And, of course, I had my dad make a strap deal where I could put a doll on my back. So I was really excited about that. And when we had Native Month, we made drums out of oatmeal containers, that Quaker oatmeal. When I was 11, my adopted mother passed away of stomach cancer. So that was just a trauma that we couldn't quite get over. My dad remarried 8 months later to my stepmother, and she was totally different. She didn't like us, which really traumatized my brother and I more. I ended up being a runaway, 13 to 16 years old. And my brother left after I turned 13. I ended up graduating high school, and my brother had found this organization called WARM, Washington Adoptees Right Movement Organization. And he got a case opened, and he wanted to seek out his birth mother. And he got the information, you know, they found her, and, you know, we were all excited for him, a little nervous too. And she turned him down. So she didn't want to meet him. So he kind of sat me down and said, look for your mom. And I was like just devastated for him. It just broke me a little. And I said, I don't think I could handle being rejected. And so I decided not to. About that time, my boyfriend and I, we got married, and I had my first child. I was devastated a little bit because losing my mom came back when I became a mom. So I went through a little bit of depression. And after the birth of my son, a minister of the Lutheran Church I went to a few times came knocking at my door. And he said, Lois, you know, your family's looking for you. I said, what? I'm like sitting there going, they know where I'm at. And the pastor said, we got a call from your aunt and uncle. Were you adopted? And I literally had to grab a counter and sit down. And I said, yes, I am. So that's when I spoke to my mom on the phone for the first time. We were both just so excited to hear each other. But when it came to the actual physical meeting, it was just before Thanksgiving. She got there an evening early, and it was snowing. I mean, it was like there's already been about almost a foot of snow in Wenatchee. And I had to push our son's stroller through the snow to get to the motel because we didn't have a car. And got there to the door, and I absolutely could not knock. It was like almost like 10 degrees out. And my husband's looking at me, Jeff, he goes, you know, are you going to knock? And I said, no, I can't. I'm about to meet her. And then he just, oh, for goodness, and he knocks. We're going to freeze. And she's inside with her husband, Arnie. And they heard the knock. And Arnie looks over at her and says, well, you going to get it? She froze and she goes, no, what if it's her? And Arnie goes, oh my goodness, we got to let him in. Went over and opened the door. I saw a short lady with dark hair and a face just like mine. And I stepped in and she saw me for a few seconds and she stepped back and lowered her head because she didn't know what I was going to do. I saw that gesture and I thought, oh, she's had it hard just like me. You know, and I just stepped forward and put my arms around her and she just melted into my shoulders and we both just cried. It was a void that I think I say that God or the Great Spirit had made just for, you know, our relationship to become what it became. I think I had to have that loss of one mom just to make room for Carol McKay Henry to step into my life and make it easier.
You've had so many different experiences with family, with adopted family, with a stepmother, with an adopted brother, with half-brothers and blood mothers and everything. What has this taught you about the nature of family and the nature of blood relations?
I think that it's taught me to forgive. It's taught me to accept. What's that famous serenity prayer? The knowledge to change what I can and accept what I can't. I first heard about that when I became a mother, so that's all 30 years of learning of what that really means.
Lois Landgrebe is a teacher and storyteller. She currently works for the Sauk Suwatl tribe. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. And to wrap up my last episode here on Sound Effect, I had to include this story. The Seattle band Culture Shock lives up to its name. They weave together Eastern European folk music with strains of metal and so-called gypsy punk. The new song Taiyu is sung all in Japanese. Culture Shock's songs promote justice and rail against fascism. Lead singer Gino Yevjevic is a burly, tattooed fellow with a shaved head, beard down to his chest, and streaked with gray. Gino's passion for art, his compulsion to create, is what eventually pulled him out of the war zone his hometown of Sarajevo had become. In 1992, Yugoslavia was busy tearing itself to pieces. The country was breaking up along religious lines, leading to a long and bloody war. But before everything descended into chaos, Gino was living the dream. He was a clean-shaven, suit-and-tie-wearing, ponytail-sporting pop star. The name of his group, Gino Banana.
Gino Banana.
We became pretty recognized. I hate the word famous and celebrity, so I don't even know how to say that. Yeah, we were like, whatever.
Did you get recognized in the street?
Yeah.
Did you sign autographs?
Yeah.
Did people want to pose for pictures with you?
Yeah. No, there was no selfies, though. Selfies did not exist. It was great. And you know what? I have to say, like, people, oh, it's horrible burden. No, it wasn't. It was great. I loved it. Especially when you're a kid. It's amazing. And, you know, but then you overgrow it. Then you overgrow it. And then maybe something like war happens to, you know, to remind you, hey. You know, I don't know what would have happened. I mean, I probably would become one of those guys at the record label, you know.
If not for the war, you mean?
If not for the war, right. You know, I envy you, actually. You guys go to war and you come back from the war. We don't go to war. War comes to us. Sitting home, minding your own business. Psh, boom.
For more than 2 months now, Sarajevo has been under siege.
Then we were trapped in the city. It's amazing. So we were in war, and you all of a sudden you can't get out, and you have a bunch of record-selling musicians in the town doing nothing.
So once the reality kind of set in of being locked down where you were, of the war being, you know, surrounding mm-hmm. Sarajevo, how did you cope? Like, where did you direct your energies?
I actually recommended my friends and these directors and choreographers and a bunch of actors. We were all in one theater, and I gave an idea to do musical Hair. I remember everybody saying, "Are you crazy, man? Anti-war musical in a war-torn country? Like, yeah, but let's twist it out. Who cares? Let's play for ourselves." We did whole musical.
Was it one performance or a series of them?
It was about 300 performances.
Oh my gosh. So were you doing it like every day?
Every single day. At 1 o'clock p.m. because we had a curfew at 9.
And did people show up?
Packed every single time. We never had one place. And we ran it for 3 years. We got devastated. Our sound guy died like first year. My guitar player and co-writer, he got injured by going to the theater. He's alive still. People took out of shrapnel out of his head. We redid the play again and running it until the point where we couldn't do it anymore.
Why was it worth risking your life to go make that show?
Selfishness is allowed in art. Art might be one and only activity of a human that can allow selfishness as a positive category. That means that you're creating what comes to you. that the creation is a purpose to itself. That's, I think, what was driving us.
At the performances, UN officials and American celebrities sat shoulder to shoulder with the trapped residents of Sarajevo. The production also happened to catch the attention of Phil Alden Robinson, the man who wrote and directed the movie Field of Dreams. What had seemed like an insane idea just a few years before, putting on an anti-war musical in a war zone, ended up being Gino's ticket out of Sarajevo. Phil Alden Robinson got visas for Gino and some of the other cast members of Hair and brought them to the United States. He wanted to make a movie about this unlikely theater troupe.
Phil could not put the movie together because probably it wasn't very attractive to, I guess, you know, it wasn't very attractive to Hollywood. There was no Steven Seagal saving Blonde from the barbarians, you know, that don't know anything else but fighting each other. You know, we were portrayed like a people, which, you know, it's not sellable, I guess. And that kind of confirmed my stand about alternative music and alternative art and never to go to the commercial world again. And then, you know, the only thing that we did, we came to Seattle and made the theater about the theater play. That was, you know, the second prize.
And so you created the play Behind God's Back,
yeah,
which was a play about the production of Hair.
Yeah.
And what was that like to do? Was it?
It was great.
Was it weird?
It was weird. It was weird. I constantly had a feeling of underperforming, not in the way of performance, but on the way of like I am. Very important for me was not to use my experience and that of many of my friends for my own gain. And in that moment, there were so many movies. Welcome to Sarajevo. Christmas in Sarajevo. What Christmas, man? You know, it's just like everybody's using Sarajevo left and right. And I didn't even want to use it in my songs. Didn't even want to use it in my theater play. If anybody should use it for the game, people of Sarajevo should use it for the game, not people over here, right? I felt it would be a betrayal of my friends.
When Behind God's Back wrapped up, Gino stayed in Seattle, he got a permanent green card, and he kept creating. In 1996, Gino formed Culture Shock. The band's still going strong with a devoted following in Europe. And then at some point, Gino found himself in a new kind of creative project as well. He writes plays, and he helps a specific population put on their own shows, people with developmental disabilities. Right now, they're working on A Midsummer Night's Dream.
It's time for me to do something for somebody else.
Do you get a different kind of gratification from that? Like, do you get a different satisfaction from that type of work than you did when you were center stage?
Yeah. I like supporting people in their achievements. I love it. I think that's what I was missing in my life. I'm finding it right now. Because it's beautiful when you see somebody achieve something, and you know that you support that. It's not about you. Art therapy and whatever, however we call it, is something that just crowned my life.
Gino Yevgevic, playwright, counselor to special needs adults, and lead singer of Culture Shock. To see a video of the band's new song, Tie You, head over to our website, knkxsoundeffect.org. Well, that is going to do it for my final episode here of Sound Effect. I just want to say that it's been an absolute privilege and a pleasure to host.
Hold on a second. Gabriel Spitzer.
Kevin Kniestad, Sound Effect producer.
You didn't really think you were going to go and sneak out of here that easily, did you?
Well, I did, actually, but somehow I'm not surprised that you're not letting me.
Well, you're not. You're not going to sneak out of here that easy. Before you say goodbye, there are a few people who had a few things to do with the show that have a thing or two to say to you.
Gabriel, you're an inspiration and a force. I consider myself very fortunate to have been part of the Sound Effect team for 3 months. There was a lot that I enjoyed during my short stint with the Sound Effect team back in the spring of 2016, but among some of my favorite moments was watching you do what you do so well, talk to folks. You bring out the truth, the memories, the emotion. Cheers to you, Gabriel, to your bright future ahead, and to the shining light that is Sound Effect. All the best. Jenny Palmer.
Hello, this is Janae Janik, sending my greetings all the way from the land down under, New South Wales, Australia. Gabe, you were such an incredible mentor during my time at the station. You patiently worked with me to develop my own voice and always treated me like an equal. I'll admit I am a bit sad that I won't be able to pop into your office for any more surprise visits, but I'm really happy for you. Congratulations on such an amazing career at KNKX, and I wish you all the best in the future.
Gabe, this is Max Wasserman. I am grateful for the time you spent with me while I was an intern and a freelance contributor to the show, and I know that the people at Seattle King County are going to be very lucky to have you as part of their team. I wish you the best of luck, Gabe.
What's up, Gabe? It's Rips, also known as Ripley, also known as Bree. I'm so excited to hear that you're pursuing a new public health path, but I'm also saddened not to hear you on Sound Effect or Transmission anymore. When I think of the soul of those shows, I picture you and I hear your voice. I just want to say thank you for mentoring me in public radio, for making me laugh until my stomach hurt the hurt of 1,000 crunches, and for giving our community countless glimpses of the humanity that unites us all.
Hey Gabe, it's Warren Lankford, former intern at Sound Effect. Heard you're leaving the show, which is very sad for Seattle. You are a great mentor and just a cool friend to have. And, you know, I'm sure everyone there will miss you greatly. And I miss you every day.
Hi, this is Erin Hennessy with KNKX. I've been racking my brain about what it is about Gabe that I've so enjoyed. And it finally hit me that nothing in the world is better than having someone you can be yourself with. And that is how people feel around Gabe. That's magic. And we're so grateful, Gabe, that you brought the magic to KNKX. Thank you.
Hey, Gabe, it's Allie. Congratulations on the new job. I am so, so excited for you. I know we're all going to miss hearing you on the radio, but in this crazy year, I'm also very thankful to know that there is someone as smart as you working to keep us all safe and healthy. So thank you so much. Congrats.
Hey, Gabe. It's Posey. I didn't think I could get through this, but I'm going to give it a try. I've had a lot of colleagues in my life, and I've had a few favorites, and you're one of them. And I'm going to miss seeing you every day. And I knew I couldn't get through this. So if you wanted to hear me break down, here it is. Going to miss you. And good luck with what's next. Okay, bye.
Hey, Gabe. Jennifer Wing here. And your energy and enthusiasm and drive to tell good stories is frankly contagious. It's been really fun making radio with you. I will miss your sincere compliments and your thoughtful critique. And not only will I miss putting a show together with you, but I'll also miss the million little conversations that we had just about life, about our kids, getting dogs. And we are all really, really excited and happy for you. So, thanks. It's been great.
Gabriel Spitzer. It's me, Arwen. This is what you get, bud. I tried 3 times to write this out, but each felt too Sisyphean. And then I read you part of Ulysses and thought, he'll know what I mean. But failures both have led me here to deliver now in verse the very simple sentiment. If I'd never met you, Gabe, my life would have been much worse.
So, you know, my turn, I suppose. You and I go back to the creation of the show, and I've spent more time with you over the last 6 years working on the show than I have with my own family. And, you know, I think there's so many moments that kind of stand out to me. But one of them, and it probably isn't the one that you'd think of, but we taped an interview that was very emotional, very intense. And, you know, we walked out of the studio a little emotionally exhausted. And after you sort of caught your breath, you said, okay, now we need to go fact check what our guest said. And I remember thinking that's a sign of a true pro. I don't say that meaning to suggest that you didn't, you know, that you didn't feel emotional about the interview, because you did, you clearly did. But you weren't going to deliver it to the listener without making sure that the listener is getting more than just emotion, but was getting the truth as well. And I think that is. I think that is just you all around. You are a constant advocate for the listener on all levels. And I just want to say thanks for everything. And I think a good motto to have is to leave it better than you found it. And you, my friend, are leaving the station better than you found it. And the show goes on. But fortunately, with your fingerprints all over it.
Whew. Well, I'm almost speechless. I'm really grateful, Kevin. And you know, just to pull back the curtain a little bit, you know, every week when we record like the introductions to the show and all the sort of scripted stuff that comes in between the stories, Kevin and I huddle up in the studio together and it becomes this little kind of ritual where we cloister ourselves up every week and do that for a while. And then at the end of those recording sessions, usually we'll have a little heart to heart to the extent that sort of thing happens. And those, you know, so much of radio is like working in isolation and putting stuff out into the world. And then you never really know what happens to it. Like you have faith that it connects with people, hopefully, but usually you don't know. You don't hear back a lot of the time. And so being in the studio there with you every week and then having a human connection at the end of the recording, to me, made me feel not adrift. It made me feel connected to the work and to the audience and to the radio, and that's all you. And yeah, so just thank you for everything, and thank you for this this kindness.
Thank you. Yeah. And I know you're going to go off and do great things. And I think the only question I have left for you is, can I have your office?
Absolutely. You might want to air it out. But yes, yeah. It's yours. Oh, man.
All right.
All right. Should we roll credits?
Let's roll credits.
Okay. Well, that's it for me today and for a while. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner. And it's hard to count all the people we've had help from over the last 6 years, including some of those voices that you heard today: Arwen Nix, Allie Ferguson, Bree Ripley, Warren Langford, Ginny Palmer, Janae Janik, Max Wasserman, Aaron Hennessy. I'll throw in just a few others there, including Shane Mailing and Bethany Denton and all the others that have made contributions to this show, and all of the ordinary human beings out there who have trusted me with their stories over the last 6 years. I just want to say thanks. Our executive producer is Florangela Davila. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. And this is KNKX.